How many of you remember the story back in the early 1990s when Johannesburg was gripped by fear as the Norwood rapist terrorized the city? Well, a name familiar to many of us, Janine Lazarus, was a journalist covering the case at the time and is part of a new documentary that is revisiting those chilling events. On the line is Janine. Janine, thank you so much for joining us, and it's such a pleasure to chat with you again after all these years. Take us back. What was it like reporting on the Norwood rapist when the attacks were happening?
First of all, hi Paula. It's lovely to speak to you. As you say, after so many years, we've been around for a long time.
Yeah, we won't say more than that.
We won't say more than that. It was the stuff of adrenaline, and it was precisely the reason I became a journalist, you know. I don't think I, in my wildest dreams, ever thought that I could get as close to a man wanted for serial rape and murder, but I did. And, you know, back in the day, there weren't, internet hadn't been born. We had just started typing our stories on these huge computers. I think we still had at that point floppy disks or something. And there was no sending WhatsApps and doing, you know, any Google. It was literally shoe leather to the pavement and off we went. So this was a story that became an exclusive, and I was absolutely determined to sweep up the opposition, and I did.
Janine, for those who don't remember, what was the story about, and why did it grip us to the extent that it did?
I lived, like many of my friends and contemporaries, in a flat in Norwood at the corner of Grant Avenue and Iris Road. There were a lot of single women living in the suburb, which in its heyday was really a wonderful place for single people. I mean, I'd walk down the road and meet friends for a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and walk back late at night, and there was no problem. It was very much, I really don't know what suburb you can maybe like Parkhurst is now, although I think a little trendier than Parkhurst. It was very hip and happening. And what happened was that two women were raped within a 2.5 kilometer radius of my block of flats. And my editor, the late Dave Hazelhurst, was astounded that as the chief reporter, I missed on, you know, two rapes that happened within spitting distance of where I lived. And my excuse was that, you know, the politics of the day and the politics at the time, we were all voting yes in the referendum. It was a very big change in our country. So people were really focused on that and not focused on a crime story that had been tucked inside the daily newspapers. When the crime started escalating, Hazy, Dave Hazelhurst, the late editor, put me on the story. And, you know, he's like most psychopath serial killers, his crimes escalated. So from climbing up the into a first floor window. I'm trying to think of what you're talking about.
I don't know. I haven't done that, so you'll have to tell me.
Yeah, you'd have to be a cat burglar. So climbing up a drain pipe into a first floor flat, pistol whipping his victims, raping them, tucking them in, wishing them good night, and escaping exactly the way he came in, his rapes morphed into murders. And interestingly enough, I was staying right in the center of the siege. So my flat was next to, or rather in front of, Jenny Matfield, who was living with an air hostess as a flatmate. She was raped and shot dead in the bath. My flat was next to a commune where an optometrist, Jenny Hitchie, lived, and she was also shot in the head. And my flat was right in the axis of the other two rapes of women that had escaped with their lives.
Wow. Janine?
Yes, I'm here.
How did you treat the story? I mean, I heard stories, and I don't know if it's correct. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, but that it was almost as if you were trying to trap him yourself. I mean, how did you decide to try and cover the story?
Well, you must remember, Paula, that back in the day, we didn't have the strict rules and regulations we do now. I mean, no editor would be seen dead throwing his report into the firing line. Mm. I was determined to get the story no matter what. And because I'd let a man who I lived and died for, I adored Hazy as an author. He taught me everything I knew. And the fact that I'd let him down and I'd missed a man, you know, conducting serial rapes in my neighborhood, I was absolutely determined to scoop the story. So at one particular point, I mean, I was an ex-crime reporter, so I knocked on the door of Brixton Murder and Robbery Squad and I spoke to my police contacts. They discovered that I was living in Nord and they asked if they could use my flat as a surveillance point. And that they did. And they put their pump action shotguns and whatever all over my cane furniture. They drank all my wine, all my beer. My two cats hid under the bed in fear. And Norwood itself is a suburb completely vacated. You would see women driving around, five or six in one vehicle, too scared to go home. And single women would move back in with their parents or back in with their boyfriends and, you know, come back in the morning to feed their animals or to water their plants. So it really became a suburb under siege. And one night, I used to teach those lycra leotard, leg warmer, high impact gym classes, step classes at what was Planet Fitness in those days. And the Nord killer was a cop. He was Lance Sergeant Jacobus Pietrus Geldenhuys. And he was living in the Nord police barracks. And the police had told me off the record that they assumed he was a cop because there was the bullets or the cartridges came from a police issue firearm. They had embedded themselves in the wall or the mattress, and they made me walk past the Nord police barracks in the middle of the night. And of course the Nord killer never jumped out and got me, which is why I'm talking to you today. And so that was the second failure, that I'd acted as a decoy at the behest of the police, and I had to tell my editor that I missed that I didn't even get that. And then finally, when the police were fingerprinting single white male policeman from Norwood police station from the barracks, he jumped ship, he moved into his parents' home in the East Rand, he jumped over the wall, he raped and killed a 16-year-old virgin called Veronica Taylor. Her mother came home and found her daughter's body sprawled over the bed. And it was at that point that not Brixton, but East Rand Murder and Robbery got him. And I wasn't in on the arrest. And Hazy was furious. He was frothing at the mouth. He was banging his coffee mug on the desk. And eventually he said, well, you know, you're going to go and sit in court and you're going to listen to the verdict. And I think he knew what he was doing, because I sat behind the killer. I smelt his sweat. I listened to the rattling of his feet and leg irons. And I watched him hang his head and look at the courtroom and tell everybody that he'd given his life over to the Lord, which they always do. And I still sat there when he was escorted down to the holding cells in the bowels of what was then the Johannesburg Supreme Court. And a plainclothes policeman came up to me and he asked me in Afrikaans why I'm crying. And I just looked at him and he said, who are you? I said, I'm Janine Lazarus. He said, you the girl reporter that's been covering the story? I said, yes, I am. So he asked if I wanted an interview with a killer. And I mean, that was my scoop. So he smuggled me downstairs to interview the Nord killer. And I went to the far cement block at the end of the passage, the end of this corridor. And the Nord killer came right up to the bars and he greeted me. He said, hello, Janine.
Wow. Janine, I just want to mention to our listeners that the reason we're covering this is that a new documentary has been released revisiting this case of Cobus Geldenhuys. What did you ask him in that interview? And now, all these years later, can you think of a question or two that you didn't ask that you think perhaps you should have?
Well, I do remember crying off all my allegedly waterproof mascara when he saw me. I do remember him taking a piece of toilet paper from a toilet roll inside his cell and him putting his hands out and wiping my tears. I remember one of the jail officials making a, and I remember it, a chutney mince snackwich, and he, because he was hungry, and the killer, you know, broke it in half, and I interviewed him chewing it, and I said, "What made you do this?" And he said, "Well, he can't stop himself. He called it in Afrikaans, the dung, which is the thing. It just would like envelop him in the middle of the night, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and he'd go and he'd go on his siege and his rampage." And that was, you know, well, what's it, 31 years ago? Mm. I was front page all over the place. I was interviewed on Carte Blanche. I got lots of international coverage. I mean, it's not often that you get a Jodie Foster moment to be smuggled downstairs and look face to face with a monster. And then it was probably 12, 14 years. I'd left news. I'd gone into media training. And the late Dave Hazelhurst called me and he said, "The killer's just asked for parole. Can you write a story?" So I did. And the headline for that story was, "God help us if he gets parole," because I'd spoken to the late, great forensic criminologist, Dr. Irma Labuschagne, and she said he would do it again. And then roll forward to kind of the mid-1990s, I think, when Clive Morris ran a series with Malcolm Gooding as our voiceover man, as our anchor, called Criminal Minds, there were 13 episodes on South Africa's 13 most famous solved crimes. And what was interesting, Paula, is that we reenacted the rape and the murder in my bath. And the next morning I woke up and I saw a cigarette burn in the tiles of my bathroom above my taps where I was brushing my teeth, because the killer frog marched Jenny Matfield into the bath. He put his cigarette out and he shot her in the head. So this story kept revisiting me. And then during lockdown, I just decided, okay, girlfriend, it's time to write a book. And after much research, and really much research, and I didn't have his ID number. I didn't know which prison he was in. I finally found out that he was at Boksburg, and I went to visit him, and I was the first group to go, the second group to go after the COVID lockdown. So he was desperate for a visitor, and he spoke to me like an empty cardboard cutout creature that he was. And I went back again and back again, and I think the third time I went back, the first time I was devastated. I cried the whole weekend. It had a hugely massive emotional impact on me. I went there, I don't know why, Paula, to find some shard of goodness in this evil. Yeah, some shard, you
and,
know.
And did you find it?
No, I mean, he told me when I interviewed him in the holding cell that he was all alone and his parents had gone to Cape Town. And despite myself, I felt a sort of a smidgen of sympathy for him, and I was trying to find it again. But on visit three to Boksburg, you know, the veil came off. I said to him, "If I was in a room with you, would you rape and kill me too?" And he said, "No, you know, you're a woman and you're vulnerable." I don't think he used the word vulnerable. And I said, "But so were your other victims." And he said, "He's a changed man and he's given his life to Jesus." He subsequently applied for parole at least 4 or 5 times, and I really hope that he doesn't get out, because he will do it again.
This documentary that's now being released, Looking Into Darkness, does it offer something new about the story? What is interesting about it for a potential viewer?
The SABC is writing this now because I just did a piece on TikTok about gender-based violence and Women's Month, and I think the documentary is being aired at exactly the right time. It's a 13-part series of women who've been mutilated, raped, murdered, strangled, stabbed in one shape or another. And it draws attention to the fact that GBV in this country has almost become like a national sport. I mean, a woman is murdered almost every 3 hours in South Africa. This is one of the most, if not the most dangerous country for a woman to live in the world.
Janine, looking back now, we said what, 30, just over 30 years,
Paul is the same age as I am. I'm 61, he's 6 months younger than I am. So he has spent he was jailed when he was 29. So he has spent 31 years in jail, and that's how long I haven't seen him. And I visited him just as lockdown was lifting.
If it happened now, is there anything you would do differently to report on the story?
No. I wish I had the gonads that I had as a youngster, you know. There would have been nothing I wouldn't have done to get him. I would have wanted to be in on his arrest desperately. I would have wanted to be there when East Rand Murder and Robbery Squad walked into what was the internal stability unit in the East Rand where he jumped ship. I would have wanted to see him hang his head and nod when they said, "Are you the Nord killer?" Yes, I wanted to be there.
You were talking about gender-based violence.
Yeah.
And why it's important for us to revisit the case. What do you hope that audiences today take away from your experience, both as a reporter and as a participant in this documentary series?
Well, first of all, that there's a very fine line in terms of ethics. I mean, you know, very often you've covered war internationally. There's a very fine line, you know, should journalists become part of the story? And the answer is obviously not. But if it means that you're covering a story in the 80s and 90s, and there is such a thing as scoops, which there isn't anymore because of social media and all things digital, you know, it's very difficult not to become part of the story. I mean, I covered the Van Rooyen case, Gert Van Rooyen, the man with the 5 or 6 missing schoolgirls. I sat on my bed until 2 o'clock in the morning speaking to the mothers who would never see their daughters again. So it throws, I think, into spotlight the questionable ethics of a reporter, the questionable ethics of the police, and the questionable ethics of an editor at the time. But remember, Paula, this was set in a time where South Africa was slowly becoming a democracy, and there were massive stories. There was a Boy Patong massacre. There was Paul Simon was the first sanctions-busting artist to play in South Africa. Madiba and F.W. de Klerk had just been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. So it was, and we'd all voted yes in the referendum. So this was a pivotal time in South Africa's history. And to get a front page on a story like this that really was not about the news of the time was a very, very big achievement for me.
I remember seeing it on the front page. For those of us, I lived in Highlands North at the time, and I think it gripped not only the community there, but the whole country. Janine, were there any new insights or revelations about Quibus or even about the investigation that you learned during the filming of this documentary? Anything new that came up for you?
Yes. I mean, the documentary's been directed by Peter Goldschmidt, who is an absolute pro, and Enver Daniel, whose crew and Enver filmed me. He was the producer and director. I mean, they found Captain John Miles. Well, he's no longer captain. He was head of the Norwood CID. They found him in George. They spoke to one of the women who survived his rape. A brother sort of came out of the woodwork, a brother of one of the victims. So there were a lot of new things, and it's quite bizarre, you know, that it left such a scar on the nation's psyche that even now, I mean, my episode flights on the 17th of September at 8:30 on SABC3, and even now, at this age and stage of my life, I've got people crawling out of the woodwork to say, "Do you know that I worked with Jenny Matfield's mother? And I witnessed the dissolution of a marriage as a result of the murder of, you know, a daughter and all of those things." But people remember it. And you know what is so interesting about this, Paula, is that the word, the moniker serial killer, didn't exist until the Nord killer came to the fore. I mean, you know, the DNA wasn't as evolved as it is now. And it was only when the Norwood killer, as I said, reared his ugly head that the whole serial killer phenomenon started being thoroughly investigated.
Janine, one last question that we have time for. You said that they were aware that it was a police officer. How long did it take them after that awareness to actually find him And why? I was under the impression they didn't know right up until the end that he was actually a policeman.
No, they knew within 2-3 weeks. The Nord killer, Jacobus Petrus Haldane, still shares, but the previous serial killer, Andrei Chikatilo, the Soviet cannibal, they made a movie on him, Citizen X. They both share this weird physical anomaly where the blood type that they have is completely different to the blood type they secrete at a crime scene. So they're essentially, they may be a blood type A, and they'll be secreting semen, saliva, whatever at their crime scene. So the police are looking for a needle in a haystack. And remember that DNA in 1992 is nowhere near to what it is now. I mean, they called the Nord killer a hoppy and a slicky. What is that in Afrikaans? A bite and a drink, because he would bite into polony or blocks of cheese and he would drink from cartons of milk or orange juice. So his DNA was everywhere. I mean, he even left his grandfather's watch at one of the crime scenes.
Janine, you said that he doesn't seem repentful at all. Did that surprise you?
Yes, because there's no closure. Because although I've covered crime and violence like you have, I mean, you've covered wars, but I've covered a lot of local crime. I mean, that was my fuel for years and years. I still can't believe that even in a heinous monster, that there isn't some shard, some sliver, if you like, of humanity. So I still feel that's bizarre, Paula. I mean, I rack my brains and ask myself, well, I still feel weirdly connected to this monstrosity of a person. I mean, a person who is lacking remorse completely, who, you know, is going to... I mean, at the time I interviewed him, he was about to get engaged to some woman who'd just been released on parole for committing fraud. She was a lot older than him. But there's so many parts of his life that make me feel so sad. I mean, he grew up with a dictatorial mother. She beat him up. She wouldn't let him go to the toilet on his own. He grew up with an absent father who was kind of there but not there. You know, he did three things, which is the triumvirate of a serial killer. He hurt his dog, but he laughed behind bars and said the dog didn't need a vet. He set fire to his parents, where they parked their car, and he also peed in his bed. And that generally is the mark of somebody with a psychopath.
Well, you learn something new every day. I didn't know those three things, and I've been writing them down. Janine Lazarus, author, public speaker, specialist, media consultant, and the journalist that covered that remarkable story of the Norwood serial killer some 31 years ago. Janine, just while you talk, I'm thinking that your story and the documentary's deeply personal lens reminds us how crime, courage, and journalism often overlap in unsettling ways. Thank you for being so honest in sharing with us your impressions, and a reminder that your interview is airing on SABC 3 the 17th of September, and you said at 8:30. And we'll be sure to watch that.